is June. It is finally here. We've been doing this thing for a full year. This is the last episode of the year, and we're going to get to do another one next year. Those of you that are leaving, good luck to you, all of you, especially the six of you that are staying here. Really good luck to you guys. For all of our residents that are staying on and becoming seniors, becoming juniors, we're going to continue to produce high quality, all right, pretty high quality emergency medicine knowledge for you. And for those of you who are brand new interns, you may be hearing this for the first time. I'm Aaron Leach. I'm one of the emergency pediatric faculty, and Jared Mosier is one of the emergency critical care faculty. We are two of the assistant program directors for the university campus, and we do this monthly podcast as a public service to pretty much ourselves, and that's about it. But sometimes people get some good stuff from it. This month, we're going to talk to Brian Drummond, who is a fantastically smart guy. He has done a lot of stuff. He's a great resource. We're going to ask him a very difficult question, which he does a pretty good job of answering. We're going to ask him, what does a paper have to do to change your practice? Really interesting stuff. We're also going to talk about nosebleeds, and we're going to do a little more of hemonc stuff because we just didn't get enough of it last time. Welcome to AZMcast. Here we go. So let me ask you a question. I hate it when Jared starts a conversation like this. Jared was a year ahead of me in residency. Actually, he ended up being 3 years ahead of me because of the five-year program. But he's a really smart guy. So if he starts a question like this, usually what he's trying to say is, I know the answer to something really smart, and I'm going to make you feel bad about not knowing it. Well, this time, I think he actually had a real question. It started a conversation about hemophilia. Hemophilia is one of those scenarios that you hope you never have to encounter. I start lots of mock scenarios with, you're about to have a bad day. A bus full of hemophiliacs just crashed on their way to hemophilia camp, and they're all coming to you. Well, let's talk about what we would do should such a horrific day ever happen in our discussion on hemophilia.
There's a patient that I've been here long enough. I've seen both him and his brother. They're both hemophiliacs. So I took care of this kid, the older brother, when he was 18. He had a sore throat, was coughing, and coughed himself into an airway hematoma. So you see this a lot more often than I do, the hemophiliacs. How do you go about managing how to replace their factors?
So there's a couple steps that I put in. First of all, if there's any, you know, airway breathing circulation, you always got to do that. For replacing their factor, most of the hemophiliacs are plugged into a hemophiliac clinic with a hemophilia nurse. And the hemophilia nurses, there's one for peds and one for adult in Tucson. They are amazing. They know them by heart. They know what their factor is. They know how much they should get. They know their birth date. They know what their favorite color is. They know all this stuff. And none of their favorite colors are red, by the way. So the first thing I want to know is, do you have hemophilia A or B? Because those are two different factors that are missing, and you need to know which one to replace. If it's hemophilia A, that's a factor VIII deficiency. So hemophilia A is going to require replacement of factor VIII, and for each unit per kilo that you transfuse a patient, you get 2% factor activity back. So that means in order to, if you assume that some patient that's got something horrible, like a brain bleed or an airway hematoma, you just assume they have never seen factor in their life, and you transfuse them up to 100%. So that means 50 units per kilo. If it's factor 9 deficiency and it's hemophilia B, then they need factor 9 replacement. Factor 8's not going to help them. And factor 9 replacement, you get 1% of activity for every 1 unit per kilo. That means that if you have factor 9, you need 100 units per kilo to get you back up to 100%. The last thing to ask is if they have an inhibitor. And an inhibitor is basically their body's not supposed to have factor 8 or factor 9 because they have a genetic mutation, so they develop an antibody against it. So you then have to give a block to that antibody, which usually is FIBA, I think is the most common one that we use, and that has to be given along with it, otherwise your factor is just wasted. So those are the three questions I ask a hemophiliac. Do you have hemophilia A or B? And then I asked them when they last got Factor. And then I asked them, do they have an inhibitor? And those can all be pretty quickly figured out by calling one of these nurses.
Recombinant factor 7 was invented for hemophiliacs with inhibitors. Mm-hmm. So, and it just turns out that it works pretty well for bleeding and whatnot. But you know, over the last couple of years, the various recommendation societies have come out and said that it should only be used for hemophiliacs with inhibitors. So would you ever foresee a situation where you're, I don't know, maybe you're at Cell Campus or maybe you're in Cells or Casa Grande or something, where they may have recombinant factor 7, but they don't have these other factors. Somebody comes in with, I don't know, let's say an airway hematoma. Would you ever give them recombinant factor 7? And if so, how much?
The only thought going through my head at this time is, I hate you, Jared. Why would you ask me a question like that? That's a tough question. Mainly because I've never been put in that situation. I don't know what the dose is. I would have to call somebody and figure it out. If I was put on the spot for it and they said, well, we have this, it's not exactly, I'd say, well, it's better than nothing. Let's give it anyway. It can. If you have a patient that has an inhibitor and you give them factor 8 trying to help, maybe some of the activity will go up. It won't go up to 100%. But it's better than nothing. Truthfully, you might as well just give them FFP or cryoprecipitate. You're going to get something in there. It's not going to be the best, but it's not going to be ideal, I should say. But it's certainly going to be better than not giving anything and saying, "Wow, oh, shoot, I don't have the right factor. I guess you're just going to die."
Yeah, factor 7 is actually kind of scary. I've given it a few times and have... Half the time it goes really well, and the other half it's catastrophe.
I think if it came down to it and I didn't have individual factor, a lot of these patients carry their factor along with them. If I didn't have the individual factor component, I'd probably give them cryoprecipitate or FFP instead of factor 7, because I am hoping that they'll at least get some of their activity back. Don't worry, that was my phone, not yours. So blood is awesome, and if it's in the right places, like your intravascular space, blood is terrible if it's anywhere else. So try to keep your patient's blood where it belongs. So while Jared and I have been hanging out, I've been picking my nose, trying to find something useful to do, and now it's bleeding. Can you help me?
I doubt it.
Probably.
Do you have an inhibitor? Are you hemophiliac?
Gosh, I hope not. I'm white enough to be. I think I'm related to some Russian czar or something.
You know, I had a patient last week. I can't remember which resident I had this with, but I think it was Judson. But I had this patient last week who had come in. She was 70-something years old and had some dental work done. And she had arterial bleeding from around her tooth where he had done this repair, and one of the palatine arteries was bleeding. You know, it's on the hard palate, so it kind of retracts back in there. You can't really hold pressure on it. So I'm sitting there thinking, how in the hell am I going to get this thing to stop? You can't inject epi into it and whatnot. So thank God she came in with her oral surgeon, who apparently was his fourth grade teacher. And he sat there and held pressure. But what I ended up doing was making this fiberglass from, you know, stuff that we make splints out of. I made this mouth guard that I could put FlowSeal in and put the mouth guard in and have it stop the bleeding. But that brings us to the topic of maxillofacial bleeding.
I'm going to have to get some MacGyver theme music to put in at the end of that.
MacGruber, making life-saving inventions out of household material. MacGruber, getting in and out of ultra-sticky situation. MacGruber, the guys are freaking genius. MacGruber!
All right, so let's talk about maxillofacial bleeding. I'm always a little bit terrified when people bleed out their face. So are they, and that's why they come into the ER. Until you've actually seen a room covered in blood from a nosebleed, it's easy to just shrug them off. But man, I hate nosebleeds. I hate taking care of them. But when they come up and they're in my room, they're the first place I go to see. Because you can exsanguinate out your freaking nose.
Yeah, the nose is a lot like the vagina. There's nasal bleeding, and then there's nasal bleeding, just like vaginal bleeding.
Yes, exactly like it. They're exactly the same. So you've got a mucous membrane that just decides to bleed. You don't really think about how much this stuff bleeds until it really gives way. So From a practical perspective, when you're approaching these, the first thing you think of is, do I have an anterior or a posterior bleed? That's what the books all say, but until you've actually seen a posterior bleed, you may think that you've seen it, but you actually haven't. So, Jared, when you walk into a room, what's your first inclination that someone's having an anterior bleed versus a posterior bleed?
Well, I think about it differently. I think about, do I have a high pressure bleed or a low pressure bleed? Because
that's not what I asked you.
Well, I'm going to answer the question I want to answer. So, if you have a low pressure bleed, that's most of the time venous, most of the time just mucosal interruption. And usually that's from the anterior third of the nasal cavity. If you have a high pressure bleed, usually they're spraying blood all over the place. They're the patient who's got, when they take the whatever off their nose, whatever they're holding pressure with, they've got a bucket that's full of blood, or they're swallowing it continuously if you put a rhinorocket in. Those are high pressure bleeds. It could either be arterial. That's the board question, is if it's a high-pressure bleed, it's an arterial bleed from somebody with hypertension. But it could just as well be a venous bleed, a high-pressure venous bleed in somebody with hypertension.
So when you walk in, you hope for the best. You hope it's one of these low-pressure ones. And you try to hold pressure on it. That's why most nosebleeds actually don't end up in the ER, even though it seems like it some days. When it starts to get dry, your Kesselbach plexus starts to dry out. You get one erosion into a capillary, and everything gives way, and you start to have a ton of bleeding. So the approach that I really liked, I think it was at the beginning of this year, this academic year, that Lisa Stone King and Allie Min brought in those dummies, and they said first thing they do when they go in, get a bunch of cotton balls, soak them in epi or oxymetazolone or neosinephrine, and then shove them up the nose, hold pressure, come back in 10, 15 minutes, and see if you can actually get those bleeds down from a combination of pressure and vasoconstriction.
Yeah, I guess I would say that's a good thing to do. I don't really know about cotton balls, because then you could lose one up there. But
yeah, they're pretty big, unless you're like Patrick Ewing. I mean,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. The last one of these I had was a guy whose nasal CPAP, the humidifier on his nasal CPAP broke, and he had a ton of bleeding, mucosal bleeding from right around the anterior rim of the nair. And he was hypertensive at baseline, so I don't really like just giving him a bunch of phenylephrine or oxymetazolone. So I looked to see if there's something that I could easily cauterize with silver nitrate. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't work, then I go to the phenylephrine. And if that doesn't work, then a rhinorocket. And if I put a rhinorocket in, then I usually, it's wrapped in gauze, I usually soak that in phenylephrine as well. What do you do?
Yeah, so I tend to take that, and I actually put some of the Lida with Epi stuff on the rhinorocket to help it slide, help it be nice and smooth, help it anesthetize, and help clamp down some of the vessels. My feeling is, if you've exhausted the silver nitrate cautery around any bleeders you can find, you've exhausted the vasoconstriction, you've exhausted just holding pressure on it, direct pressure. Like, a nose clamp is so much better than having a patient hold it themselves, because they check it every 10 seconds, and then you just break that seal. If that doesn't work, I usually will go to the rhinorocket, and I will then usually do the anterior and posterior, because I'm not convinced that I'm getting control of the bleed, and I'm not convinced it's all anterior. So you might as well just do it once, because any of you that have ever put a rhinorocket in a patient, it's painful, man. Their eyes water up, and they're thanking you but secretly wanting to kill you after putting this in.
Especially if you put air into it.
If you put air into it before or after.
After, right? It's not comfortable.
No, it's really uncomfortable, but you're trying to tamponade this bleeding. So that's usually my progression that I will do for a nosebleed, is I'll try directed pressure, I'll try some vasoconstriction, I'll try some silver nitrate cautery. You always want to make sure before you insert anything into the nose that you get any blood clot out. So I say, and please, for the love of God, wear a face mask. So you get them all set, you get whatever you're going to try, your silver nitrate cautery, your cotton balls, your rhinorocket, and you go, ready, blow your nose. And they blow these giant clots out, cough them out, you shove whatever you want up into their nose, and that's your first attempt. And then your second attempt, by the time I get to Rhino Rockets, I'm getting a little bit concerned.
Yeah, if you put a Rhino Rocket in and the blood is still draining down the back of their throat, then you have not controlled that bleeding. When do you pull the trigger on FlowSeal?
So I've never had to use it. So FlowSeal for me would be right after I've tried a Rhino Rocket that's not working and right before I call ENT.
Yeah, I agree. FlowSeal, if it works, it's amazing, but it's super expensive. And if it doesn't work, it creates this just mega mess that you have to deal with and you can't see anything up there.
And not you, but your ENT colleagues. So usually in order to hasten their consult to make them come down faster, I say, I've got this nosebleed. I've tried everything. I'm about to put FlowSeal into them, and I wanted to give you a call. Don't do that.
Yeah.
I'll be right there. Don't mess with this field that I'm going to have to work in by injecting cobwebs into it.
Yeah, so. And they have nasal specula and headlamps and stuff that really helps them get a visualization of what it is. And if it's a big time posterior bleed or a high pressure bleed, really you got to have direct pressure or tamponade. And sometimes you just have to bite the bullet and put the Foley catheter in there. So how do you put the Foley catheter in there?
I keep it deflated. I run it straight along like I'm putting in an NPA, blow up the balloon, pull back until it stops. And then I get a hemostat and I put a bunch of tension on it and clamp it right at their nair.
Yeah, I do the same thing. You want to make sure you use a big enough one. If you use a pediatric one, sometimes you'll pull the balloon back into the nasal cavity and it won't actually tamponade it. But I put it in there and then I have them open their mouth and I look to see and make sure that it is actually as deep as I want it to be, because the nasal cavity is actually pretty big. So you put it in there, you could make sure that you can see it in the tip of the Foley catheter in the oropharynx, blow up the balloon and pull it back until you get tension, and then you want to make sure it stops. So almost like a Minnesota tube for the nose.
So we'll go even one more from that now you've put in Foley catheters, you've done all of this stuff, you're out of MacGyver ideas, and the patient is still having a lot of bleeding. You've got a real airway issue. And sometimes you just got to take control of that airway. Intubating someone who is bleeding profusely from their face is not something that I take lightly. I've only had to do it once. The guy was here for a post-tonsillectomy bleed, and lo and behold, he found out he had von Willebrand's disease at the same time and was just pouring blood out of his mouth. We had to intubate him to get control, and then I guess I'll have to agree with what you said. The nose is quite like the vagina. We took a bunch of Curlex and we packed his mouth so that we could get direct pressure on it. The other thing that we did in his case was give him a whiff of DDAVP in hopes that would help a little bit and get some von Willebrand's factor out there. But directed pressure, vasoconstriction, tamponading, these are really the ways that you deal with bleeding. And if you've got a coagulopathy, find it. Do you check a CBC on every nosebleed that you have?
If they're an old frail person, I do, yeah.
I check in on them, and I check in on any kid that's got a bad nosebleed to make sure this isn't their first presentation of ITP. Because that, for kids, is usually just a post-viral thing. It can also be an issue with you suddenly find they have a white count of 30 along with anemia and low platelets. So if they look pale, if they look poor, or if this is the first time they've really had this bad of a bleed, I'll consider it, unless it's really easily controllable and it's just dry outside.
So let's go back to that post-tonsillectomy bleed patient, because I had one, probably my most favorite airway of residency was this post-tonsillectomy kid that I had. And it's always the same story. It's had a tonsillectomy 5 days ago, and then the scab falls off and you unleash fury. So let's say somebody comes in and sees you. They're an adult, so we don't have to worry about weight-based stuff. They come in, they see you, had a tonsillectomy for chronic tonsillitis 5 days ago, and now they're having some bleeding. How do you progress through it? What would you do first?
Well, so first thing is, if they're able to tell me I had a tonsillectomy 5 days ago, airway seems patent, so I'll take a look in the mouth. For those of you that have never seen tonsils after they've been operated on, it looks awful. The whole mouth looks like it's infected and there's just pus everywhere. That's actually totally normal granulation tissue. That's what it's supposed to look like. So I look in the back and I see if I can see any active bleeding.
So you see a little venous oozing.
Okay. So a little bit of oozing from right there, I'm probably just going to call their ENT and put them on a monitor, watch them closely, make them NPO, and see if there's something else that needs to be cauterized.
They were operated on at a surgery center up by Northwest.
What are you getting at?
I'm just trying to go through the algorithm.
Okay. So, I'll call RENT on call, or if they are someone that's having just a small amount of oozing, I'll call some ENT that I have available at my hospital, explain the situation, because they really shouldn't be, you get the scab that falls off, and they should bleed a little, but you want to make sure that they've got follow-up. I'm certainly going to observe a patient like that for a few hours to make sure that everything's truly gone and that they're not going to unleash fury a second time and bleed to death in their sleep. For kids, I know several of our ENTs say, if there was any post-tonsillectomy bleeding, bring them in, give me a call. We may just obs them overnight to make sure, because it's tough to quantify in a little kid. In an adult, I'll try to get them to quantify how much they puked up.
I usually have them gargle with ice water first. If it's just a little bit of bleeding and I'm waiting to talk to their ENT, I'll have them gargle some ice water and see if that can get it to vasoconstrict down. MacGruber! Let's say you do that, then all of a sudden they unleash fury. Then it becomes, then it's an arterial bleed. Mm-hmm. And the way the tonsillar pillar is the artery is tented there and it gets retracted back. And so you can't, there's nothing to really grab onto. So, you know, the one I had, we tried putting a figure eight suture through it. We tried everything we could think of. We tried putting a clamp on it and it just bleeds and bleeds and bleeds and bleeds. So at some point.
Was this before or after they were intubated?
This was after they intubated. Okay. So you intubate them. And intubating them is difficult because they have this arterial spurter in the back of their mouth that's just throwing blood at the airway the whole time. So that's a different discussion on how to intubate those. But you intubate them, and then I do the same thing. I pack their mouth with Curlix, and then I soak it in Epi.
Yep.
See if you can get it to stop. If it doesn't stop, if it's still just flooding the Curlix, then you can try to inject epinephrine right into the source of bleeding. But we couldn't get this thing to stop until we ended up calling Dr. Perry, and he came in and he gave me some good tips. He said, you know, if you ever are faced with this and you can't get a hold of an ENT, call down to the OR, ask for a Bovi and the retractor. He said, ask for the tonsillectomy retractor. And what the tonsillectomy retractor does is it just like at the dentist, it keeps your mouth open and you can clip the ET tube under it so it gets everything out of the way. And he says, and then just take the Bovi, said you're not going to hurt anything, put it on coag, and just fry the tonsillar pillar. So just fry everything, and it will stop. MacGruber!
All bleeding stops eventually.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like we said, putting pressure on it. Put your finger in their mouth and push and hold tightly. Try to keep them sedated and try to keep them comfortable. And see if you can get the bleeding to stop that way. It's definitely not an ideal thing, and this is why the ENT people get paid so much money to do what they do day in and day out.
Yeah, you can have a tremendous amount of bleeding.
So let me ask you one more thing to kind of wrap this up a bit. What do you think about the ENT dogma that, well, their blood pressure is just too high. Get their blood pressure down and it'll stop bleeding. Mouth, nose, any of these sources.
I mean, there's definitely logic behind that. If the pressure's high and you're dumping fluid out of a hose, eventually get the pressure so low that the fluid doesn't get to the top of that hole, then it's not going to come out, right? That's the logic behind it. But I think that the face and brain are so well auto-regulated that they're going to maintain bleeding no matter what their blood pressure is until they're near shock.
Yeah, I think that you can give patients whatever you want. You can put them into a hypotensive coma if you want to, hang them on Esmolol and all kinds of stuff, but they're going to keep bleeding because they're freaking out because they're bleeding out their nose and their mouth. So
blood pressure 200 is probably not helpful, but it's not the reason why they're bleeding.
Right. Exactly. So you can try to get in touch. You can try to get that under control. It's certainly going to help. I wouldn't go to the point of trying to dump their blood pressure in order to control the bleed. So in summary, you've got someone who's bleeding out their face. You want to try direct pressure. You want to try vasoconstriction, airway protection above all, and get them to a subspecialist, ENT, anybody that can manage something that is not stopping with your best interventions. I found that these are some of the times where I get the most creative. And when you start describing some of this stuff that people are going to do, the ENTs go, what on earth? Man, that didn't stop it? All right, I'm on my way in. We had a lady who was bleeding profusely from a dental abscess who had an artificial heart valve and was on Coumadin and her INR was too high. I said, well, just reverse her INR. I go, I can't do that. Her valve will clot off and she'll need surgery again. Well, I don't know what to tell you. So I worked out with one of our pharmacists. We were actually going to take FFP, put it on gauze, and soak it on the lady's tooth. And man, was that a difficult conversation to have with the blood bank. MacGruber! We ended up not doing it, but that was the last straw that we had. And our pharmacist at the time was like, oh yeah, I've seen somebody do this once. Do I want to be the person that's done it the second time? Because I don't know the outcome from the first one. But, you know, being a little bit creative with these is good. Like Jared said at the beginning, like some of his MacGyver stuff he's had to do. There are lots of tricks because we've had to develop this over time. And no two nosebleeds I've ever found to be treated the same way.
They can be very frustrating.
They're always different. But I would encourage you to pick them up now in residency while you're under my license and Jared's license. Because when you get out there on your own, if you don't have a good way of dealing with these, then they're really going to suck. Before we do our segment with Brian, we here at AZMcast realize that not everybody can make it to conference all the time, so we would like to do a conference wrap-up where we discuss the highlights of conference from the last month. Here, with our first conference wrap-up, we have Dr. Nick Stea. So, Nick, how was conference this last month? This has been conference wrap-up with Dr. Nick Stea. Brian Drummond was nice enough to sit down with me, and we're going to talk about something that is near and dear to everybody in academic medicine, and that's evidence-based medicine. We've purported for years that we can't just do expert-based medicine. We have to do evidence-based medicine. But any of you that have ever gone on that evidence-based medicine website that Sam has for looking up journal articles, you know there's a hierarchy. There's good evidence-based medicine. There's not-so-good evidence-based medicine. And we see all these papers that get emailed out all the time. And the question I wanted to pose to Brian was, what does it take for a paper to change your practice? We see a fair amount of these papers come through. We read them and either say, wow, I'm going to go do that tomorrow. Or we say, oh, that's nice. And I'm going to keep doing exactly what I'm doing. So we'll talk about a couple papers specifically, but just in general, Brian, what does it take for a paper to change the way that you practice medicine?
I think the things, Aaron, that I'm looking for in a paper that what's going to change my practice is something that has to be clinically based, something that's done in an ER setting with an undifferentiated patient population, not the very specific group that's seen only in an academic research center or something that's case-based. So you're looking for, you know, large randomized controlled trials or large cohorts that have enough relevance to your day-to-day practice and not just zebra cases. Those are great for case reports and then have knowledge on, but that doesn't help me when I'm going to see the patient at the bedside with an undifferentiated shortness of breath, abdominal pain, headache.
Yeah, that one patient that you say, that one time I saw that guy and he had mucormycosis. Therefore, everybody is getting a face MRI.
Mucor for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So does the journal that an article is published in change your opinion of whether or not you're going to adopt it?
I think there's a lot of journals out there. So trying to sift through and how do you sort through which journals are good? I think New England Journal, JAMA, Lancet, we know the big journals that are out there, but most of those papers aren't really applicable. You can maybe pull one or two out of the big journals. So if you can sort through those, and really it's just titles would be my first thing that I would look at. And then if it goes, then I would look at the major emergency medicine annals, academic emergency medicine, JAM, West JAM, look for something that seems bigger. Bigger usually is better, but not always. Sometimes it just means I paid money to the right people. I have my article or I have a big name and I'm reporting something that some company wants me to fund and put out there. So it does factor in, but it's not the only determinant. Some of the smaller journals actually will allow negative studies that you don't want to report on negative studies all the time. But sometimes the negative helps me determine what the positives are.
Yeah, I found that reading some of these like New England Journal articles or Lancet articles, they're not very useful to me. And having said that, I'm probably never going to get an article published in one of those now. But some of the ones that I've found to be best are some of the smaller journals that seem to be more practical, but then you actually have to read the material and see what they did. So what do you, how do you approach an article to determine, am I going to apply this, or even am I going to finish this article?
I think the first thing I'll do is take a quick glance at the title. If the title seems non-applicable, done. On to the next one. That's it, you know.
Big Sharpie marker.
Right. But yeah, so I'll look at the title first, and then after I look at the title, I'll do a quick scan of the abstract and try to see what the conclusions are, and I'll actually work backwards. So I'll see conclusions, what did they actually conclude, and then I'll go back to the question and say, what's the question they addressed? And if both of those seem interesting in an abstract, I'll continue reading and then look through and see if it's truly applicable or not. And if it's not, if the results show a total patient number of 9, that's probably not an article I'll skip over. But when you start to have bigger numbers, especially for a lot of these articles, I think it becomes more applicable than a smaller study size as well.
Yeah, some of the ones that I've read that before I actually try to apply this to something I'm going to do, those are the ones I go over with a fine-tooth comb. And I actually go back to my statistics books and go, does this make sense? Does this seem like it worked out? What were the outliers? Who did they determine is actually valid for this study? I think those are the ones you really go over carefully before you say, now let's go try this on a patient of mine.
Right. I think for applicability, you have to look at the inclusion and exclusion criteria more so than the results, because that's going to tell you, can you apply it to a patient that you have? And if you can, then you look at the results and, okay, now I'm going to try to apply this. What am I going to do with it? And sometimes they'll, you know, there's a lot of articles that'll hide things in the inclusion and exclusion, which just seem off the wall. They don't make any sense. And you look at it and you're done.
So let's get to the papers. We've got 4 papers that hopefully everybody has heard of before. And we're going to talk not so much about these papers to critically appraise them, but whether or not these are ones that you incorporate into your practice and why some of these are quickly adopted and some of them aren't. Again, this is kind of our opinion, but these are papers, some of which are very quickly adopted. Everybody will say, yeah, I use that article, I use that paper. And some will say, well, I don't really use that one because I have a problem with it. And there's a little bit more of a debate. So the first one is Association of the Ottawa Aggressive Protocol with Rapid Discharge of Emergency Department Patients with Recent Onset of Atrial Fibrillation or Flutter. Those of you that have listened to our podcast for any length of time know that this is the first journal article ever mentioned on our podcast. So we're starting to get, highbrow now. So this was in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine in 2010. It's a paper by Ian Steele, who is a very good researcher. He's very good with his statistics. And basically, they took 660 patients with atrial fibrillation that were, they could try to put a finger on the onset, and they did a rapid turnaround. They cardioverted them either chemically or electrically in the ED, and then had them follow up with cardiology as an outpatient. This was something that they showed, we can get people in and out of the ED faster, the outcomes seem to be great, it'll reduce hospital admissions, it's effective, it's safe, it's perfect, why would there ever be any issues with it? And yet I still have a fair amount of attendings when I was a resident and this came out that said, yeah, I don't buy it. So what do you do? Do you employ this or?
I do, actually. And I like this article. I've been using this for the last few years. And I do probably a modified Ottawa Drummond protocol. and part of that's just on availability of drugs. So you know, in this paper, Aaron, they looked at starting first with a chemical cardioversion. So they use procainamide in every patient. And so I don't. Why? Because procainamide takes an hour to infuse. It's hard to get from pharmacy. It's not in my Pyxis. And it doesn't work all that well. So I skip the procainamide step. So I try to look and find someone and, you know, AFib, RVR, I know it happened within 2 days. How are you feeling? Oh, I feel fine otherwise. You don't have sepsis? No, I don't have sepsis. You don't have heart failure? No, I don't have heart failure. You otherwise look pretty good. Yeah, I hate this fluttering in my chest. It doesn't feel good. Oh, I have a good solution for you. And then I'll talk to them about cardioversion. And some of them have had it before. Some of them have not. But those that I've talked to like it. And I'll do a fentanyl and propofol like they talk about here in the article. I do it a little bit different from another Canadian with the propofol. I'll get the fentanyl on board first, give them some propofol in 10 milligrams at a time every 20 to 30 seconds from the Jim DeSham kind of camp of a slow. Titrate them to maybe 40 to 60 milligrams. At this point, they're sleepy and getting a little slower in their speech recognition. Zap them, they're awake in 10 minutes. So the whole procedure takes less than 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. They're back in a normal sinus rhythm. I have had excellent results with this in probably 20 patients. And I get them out of there in under 3 hours. So I actually, you know, when they talked about their turnaround times, and here they were going between 4 to 6 hours that they were holding them for an entire ED stay. And I can get some of these patients out in 3 to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. So after I can cardiovert them, I'm able to watch them for an hour, let them eat, drink, wake up from the sedation. But the patients love this. I mean, I don't send them home on any anticoagulation like they talk about in the article, but you get them an outpatient follow-up. They can have their outpatient echo. They love it. They go home. I had a guy from Louisiana who was driving through at South Campus a couple weeks ago. He got up, was walking out, felt great. And I don't know about you, Aaron, but if you've ever had AFib, people describe it as not comfortable. I think I had it for 30 seconds one night, probably after some alcohol and exercise.
A little holiday heart.
But I think there's hesitancy in this is because, one, you're sedating someone. That takes time if you're doing – or you're doing a, well, I'm going to hold them for 4 to 6 hours. Maybe I'll just admit this person, right? In med school, we would just start them on DIG and Coumadin and admit them to the floor, and that's an easy ED dispo. But – this is a slower process, but at the same time, you're saving a hospital admission. And that's big money, and that's big time overall. So I think it's hard to say why not everyone does it. A lot of AFib, I know I talked with Kurt Denninghoff recently, and you know, a lot of AFib will spontaneously resolve for these short time. I've only had it for 2 days. So if I do nothing, they're going to go back into a normal sinus rhythm. The other thing is I've done sedations on these patients where you give them some propofol, and that converted them. Mm-hmm. So I give them propofol, they're already converted. Well, I don't give cardioversion or anything else, you're done. So why do I need a cardioversion if they're going to go back anyway? And the outcomes, they're probably going to do well either way. But I think being aggressive in these patients and getting them out of a miserable heart condition, I'm for it. It's not for everyone, but it's a nice technique to offer patients, and most of them really like it.
So one of the reasons when I had asked people why they didn't want to do this, and this is something I think you need to take into mind when you're going to apply a paper, especially in a new job, one of the biggest things I heard is our cardiologists aren't set up for this. Our cardiologists aren't aware of this. So it was a systems issue. They felt this paper was not generalizable to their practice because their cardiologists were not okay with this. There was also a bit of trepidation of, well, how do I know that that was truly the onset of their AFib or A-flutter? What if they've got a little clot and I cardiovert them and then they stroke out in front of me and I could have prevented this? This is new evidence. This is scary. And it can be tough to overcome that unless you're naive like me in your first year of practice. Hey, I just read an article. I think Peter Rosen said one time, one of the most dangerous things is an intern with an article. He said that when I was an intern. I don't know if it was me specifically. But, you know, when new evidence comes out, you don't want to be the first person to adopt it. You don't want to be the last person to adopt it. So it can be a little difficult to find when this has truly been spelled out.
Well, I think the interesting thing with cardiologists not being aware of it cardiologists that I've worked with have sent in patients and said, oh yeah, we got this pill in the pocket. You just need to observe them for 4 to 6 hours while they take their ibutaline. Mm-hmm. That's not fun.
No.
That is a horrible ER visit, and I don't want to see those patients. But somehow, it's okay. The cardiologist trusts this pill in the pocket or take it at home mm-hmm. with an unknown time and not anyone seeing the patient. But if I do
but a not a shock.
Version, right. And I do a shock, now I'm obviously jarring that clot from right. the atrium.
Well, let's look at the next one that we were going to do. So this was in the British Medical Journal in 2011, another Ian Steele paper. This is the sensitivity of a CT performed within 6 hours of onset of headache for diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage, a prospective cohort study. So to give you a brief summary of this one, so this was 11 tertiary care emergency departments across Canada. And they used a CT scanner, a modern third-generation CT scanner, and they scanned everybody that came in with concerning symptoms for subarachnoid. This is a spontaneous, not a traumatic, subarachnoid hemorrhage. And they tried to see if they could effectively rule this out by getting a head CT within 6 hours. And they enrolled 3,132 patients, and they found a sensitivity of 100%, a specificity of 100%, a negative predictive value of 100%, and a positive predictive value of 100%. So this was great because there are those large patients that you got to get the harpoon LP needle out. And if they come in within 6 hours, send them to the scanner, scan's normal. You don't have to go fishing around in their lumbar region trying to find their spinal canal, not their venous plexus. This was definitely one that when I tried to bring this up as a resident, attendings were like, whoa, you still have to tap. I don't care what this paper shows. We're not missing this. What do you think about this article?
Well, I think it's an interesting article, and you have to, with some of these articles, look at previous articles by the same authors and try to figure out what they're looking to accomplish. And Perry's put out a bunch of articles on subarachnoid hemorrhage, with the goal being that they feel that what we do for subarachnoid hemorrhage is inefficient. And they put that in most of their papers in quotes, inefficient. And the goal is to try to, which it probably is in some ways, but the goal is trying to reduce the number of LPs and the time in the ED, which is reasonable because we're really looking at subarachnoid hemorrhage from a fear perspective. We're worried about missing this disease because we're told to be afraid, even though it's a rare disease to find. And the only Hunt Hesses we're really looking for are the ones and twos, people who are neurologically normal, no focal neuro exam, who have a headache. And this is actually a pretty applicable study because they took away anyone with, you know, altered mental status, abnormal neurologic findings. Yeah, they had to have a
the first-year medical student can find that one from across the room.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is a higher-level thinking, and the thought is now we're going to have higher-generation CTs. The interesting thing is this study started in 2000 to 2009, and CT has evolved much since 2000 and what we were doing and what we're doing now. So it's interesting they have a large range on this. I think overall we are looking for a disease that is only in 6% of the population. You know, it's maybe 6% of that headache population. And that's what they talk in their, you know, Perry's done some studies with their kind of cohorts from Canada. And then you're looking for, okay, if I got a negative CT scan in that population, what is my risk that's truly still exists? And I think, you know, they didn't LP everybody in this study, so some people talk about that. They talk about having a neuroradiologist, but they also mention maybe it's just a general radiologist who read the CT. So you have to have someone, not just a radiology resident, reading that CT scan. But going forward with it, still other papers will talk about a sensitivity of 93%. Well, if I take that sensitivity of 93%, my pretest probability 6%, I'm going to break it down, and my post-test with a negative CT scan is going to be less than 1%. And it's probably going to be 1 in 200 on average. So, and we see this in practice. We have a lot of these workups. We see TNLP, and most of them are negative. So how many LPs do we do to find a positive? So how do I apply this? Well, I kind of CT only in patients, and I'm not advocating this as a practice, but I will CT in headache patients that I may be a little worried about, but I really don't think they have subarachnoid, and skip the LP. But I'm using it as a baseline headache study, saying that they now have a CT done. I've excluded mass, I've excluded a sinus issue, but this is their baseline. I don't think it's, they need an LP. I don't think it's subarachnoid hemorrhage. I think, though, if I really go after the ones I really think have subarachnoid, even if my CT is negative, they're going to get an LP.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is lending some credence to the early on, you can do CT and probably be okay. But it also allows you to do kind of a shared decision making with the patient and say, your CT is negative. Your pretest probability was this. I think there's probably a 1 in 100, 1 in 200 chance, because a lot of patients don't want the LP. And they're going to elope mm-hmm. and run away from you if you come at that needle with them. And you can talk to them intellectually and say, hey, there's maybe a 1 in 100, 1 in 200 chance you have this condition. Now, we have to treat, the number needed to treat, I think some people have looked at is 3. So it's a treatable disease for aneurysm. But, you know, what are you going to do with that? And if the patient is adamant against it, I don't force it on. But I think it allows articles like this, and as we're progressing with subarachnoid early on, I think we can lessen the amount of LPs we do. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, if you think it's subarachnoid, though, you should definitely still do an LP.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I had heard for critiques of this is that their actual prevalence of subarachnoids was higher in this paper than any other paper that they have seen in that they've referred to. It was 7.7%, which is a lot, because considering I've still never really seen one. I'm sure I've missed one, but I've never seen one. So, you know, to say that we have a great test to rule out a disease that is not very prevalent, that's tough to do, because you really have to do a long study. 9 years, 3,100 patients is a lot. I think that's something why, some reason why people are hesitant to adopt this is, you're telling me you have a perfect test to rule out a disease that is very rare and difficult to pick up. And I don't know if I buy that just yet.
Well, some of the, you know, the reference articles, they talk like the Vanderwall and I think the Morgenstern, they have higher prevalences of subarachnoid at like 25%, which that's a crazy amount for a population that's presenting to an ED with headache. But even, you know, if that's the case there with the 7% and the real prevalence is much less, mm-hmm. then our chant, this actually may lead credence to, okay, they still were getting negative CTs and they weren't missing a lot of people. So if it's even less prevalent, mm-hmm. maybe a negative CT in a less prevalent population, even your risk for a subarachnoid with a negative CT maybe is 1 in 1,000, yeah. 1 in 2,000. The problem is, I think you try to apply this to every headache patient.
Mm-hmm.
These are high risk headache patients. This isn't the chronic migraineur. This isn't the headache patient that you see because, like, oh, it's the worst headache of my life, and they're 20 and it's their first headache. You know,
you don't want to apply this like a D-dimer. You know, a D-dimer was supposed to rule out people that were moderate risk on a Wells score. And instead, everybody that had a chest got a D-dimer. And then we start scanning people that didn't necessarily need it. So even within this, their criteria for applying this paper was, you have to have had a thunderclap headache, something that sounded awful. You have to have a story that seemed consistent with it. If you got a CT within 6 hours and it was negative, you're totally in the clear. I think that one of the great things when you're talking about shared decision making with a patient is when we tell them percentages to use something that's a little bit reasonable. I have a hard time with the 1%. 1% is kind of a tough number for me to wrap my brain around. Chris Williams had this great talk that he gave about risk assessment. He said, if you tell someone 1%, oh, that doesn't seem that bad. Well, it's actually 1 in 100. Whoa, I'm not okay with 1 in 100. Then you show it to them on a pie chart. They go, no, definitely not okay with that. So, you know, it's how do you want to present your statistics? But when you're able to gauge it against the risk of your intervention, it helps. So the PERC criteria and this next article we're going to talk about, the PCARN head CT criteria, gauges your risk of having the disease versus your risk from getting the CT scan, which usually is about 2% is what they'll say. So if your risk of the disease is less than 2%, you're probably better off not getting the scan. So we can talk about this next one. So PCARN is one that was very quickly adopted by a lot of people. And this is a highly prevalent injury. This is a highly prevalent disease, head injury in kids. So this was published in 2009. It's identification of children at very low risk of clinically important brain injuries after head trauma. So this is 42,000 children that they split into a derivation and a validation population. The nice thing about this is they took a bunch of guinea pig children and said, well, which ones end up having bad head bleeds? Okay, so we'll take the ones that don't, and then immediately turned around and applied it to even more children. So the first was something like 8,000 kids less than two and 25,000 older than two, and that's where they got their derivation, and then turned it around and applied it to more kids. And they found that it was a fantastically sensitive study so that they wouldn't miss anything. This one was adopted pretty quick. In pediatric literature, it's pretty tough to adopt practice changes very fast. Now, some of this is just publishing our gestalt that we've known for years, but it's nice to have this in the back. Do you use this?
Yeah, Aaron, I use this as a validation of what I do more mm-hmm. than anything. I think the looking through the criteria and what they incorporate into their decision rule is, in a sense, a physician gestalt and a good history and physical on a kid. And if you're doing that looking for this, this is showing you that you're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I think, tells me that we should trust that a little more than we do. Mm-hmm. Seeing that in this population, 30% of patients were scanned. I mean, that's a lot of CT
scans.
A lot
of kids.
A lot of kids for head injury. And the last time, I think I'm probably much lower than that. So I guess that's good.
I
missed them all. They're all dead now. But, I'm probably less than 5% mm-hmm. of all comers head trauma in kids. And I think because most kids do well mm-hmm. and look good and rarely need neurologic outcomes, which you kind of see in this. So one way I was told that you could apply this to is, say your mom comes in, has kiddo, had a head bump, kid looks great. You've examined the kid vomited once, normal neurologic exam, no hematoma, no skull fracture. You know, they're running around the room trying to eat Cheetos. And you talk to mom and say, you did the right thing to bring this kid in, but they look good. Johnny looks good. I want to send Johnny home. I don't think we need to do a CT scan. I don't want to give Johnny cancer. And mom looks at you and says, you're absolutely crazy. And I want to scan this kid. This is a great, you could break this out and show mom, if this was your child and we went through these questions, here's numbers from 42,000 kids. That's huge. Like, this is
all over the country. Very generalizable.
Very generalizable and easy to ask questions. They broke it between the nonverbal and the verbal.
Mm-hmm.
So you can show that to mom, and mom can look at it and have some real numbers and real data and see that you're not just making this up and trying to get mom out of the ER, mm-hmm. which you are. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you're wanting to validate her concern and at the same time not irradiate her kid unnecessarily.
I think one of the important parts of applying a study that tries to rule something out, so this is a very sensitive study. This has a great negative predictive value. So you're ruling out a disease. You're saying that that disease is not there because I'm applying these, is that if you don't meet all these criteria, it's not a very specific study. It doesn't have a great positive predictive value. If you fell from 3.5 feet, you can't really fall back on PCARN to say, oh, well, you're PCARN negative, you don't have a bad head bleed. But that also doesn't mean you have to scan the kid.
Correct.
You just can't use PCARN.
Right.
Same with the PERC rule. If you have one of the things that's off on the PERC rule, doesn't mean you have to scan the person, but it just means you can't use PERC. You just are out there as if there was never any such thing as PERC or PCARN. And you have to make sure that you're applying these appropriately to the appropriate kids that were studied. I'll also say that if you've got a kid that comes in that has hemophilia, you better be getting that kid a CT scan, okay? Because if you don't, he's not going to live long enough to get cancer, okay?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the numbers, and I think when I'm looking at these kind of studies and applying it, you see at the decision points the values of the yes and no. And some of it, it's sometimes a twofold difference or a threefold, and sometimes it's almost a hundredfold. Well, we know which criteria is a little more important. I mean, in this, you talk about clinical signs of a basilar skull fracture. Yeah, I'm scanning that kid if they clinically look like it. But at the same time, mechanism of injury, I think mechanism's hard. Rollovers now, we see people walk away from 65, 70 mile an hour rollovers because of seat belts and car seats. And yeah, they bonk their head, but that's a high mechanism, but yet they're walking away from it. But a fall off a bike, that could be a whole lot worse.
Yeah.
So it's finding the right criteria and just applying it and using your clinical knowledge.
Well, let's go to the last one. We'll go to the Rampart study. So this is one that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2012. And this was done by the NET investigators who just came and spoke at our joint conference. And this was something that was studied. We were one of the study centers for this. This is intramuscular versus intravenous therapy for pre-hospital status epilepticus. So this was a double-blind, randomized, non-inferiority trial. They basically wanted to see, is intramuscular midazolam as effective, or at least not worse, than intravenous lorazepam for children and adults in status epilepticus. Any of you that have ever tried to put in an IV on a kid know that it's not easy. Now imagine they're seizing. It's definitely not easy in the field. And our paramedics do an awesome job getting access.
In the back of a rig that's bouncing.
Yeah, that's bouncing as they're flying over speed bumps. So it's not easy to get a line. So this would be great if they could just stab them in the butt with some benzos and hopefully stop them. So they found that it was highly effective. So they found that they were able to stop status nearly 3 minutes earlier by giving them intramuscular dosing compared to intravenous dosing. And they found that the intubation rates were essentially the same, 14.1% in the Versed group, 14.4% in the Ativan group. The recurrence of seizures were about the same. So they said, yeah, it's fine. You can go ahead and use Versed. So now all of our medics are doing this. One of the things that when I kind of told this upstairs to our intensivists, they looked at the doses and said, that is a whack of benzos that they are giving these people. If you look at the methods, it's a huge amount of benzodiazepines. They're giving
10 or 5.
Yeah. Yeah, they're giving 10 of Versed if you're greater than 40 kilos. And if you're 13 to 40, they're giving 5 of Versed, which is quite a bit of Versed. And our PEDS people were saying, this is ridiculous doses. Where did they get these numbers? Well, it worked. Right. So it worked. And this was very quickly adopted into our EMS literature. And this is what our medics are doing now. The high intubation rates, I think that's just because we're an academic medical center and we like to tube people. Yep. But does the fact that we studied this here have any bearing on something that we are going to quickly adopt? If we put all the effort into it, we put resources into it, we believe it, and then we get the answer we like, we're going to adopt this practice right away.
Oh, I think so. I mean, this is, it's just one of the biases that get incorporated in the studies. You do it in a center, you've worked on it for many years, you've been a part of it, you've seen the results. It's much easier to buy into that than someone hands you a paper and says, oh, you got to do this, which may be counter to what you believe or think or have been taught. Now you've got to untrain all those neurons and retrain it into a different way. So I agree, Aaron. I think this is, to me, it makes sense though. And the thing with midazolam is it's really not studied. No, there is no, it's off label for the FDA. So dosing wise, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20, maybe 20, maybe we're underdosing. We should go higher.
It's a great drug. I want to put it in blow dart form.
Well, that's what they should use. It's sort of like you just have blow darts. They could hit kids as they walk up to them. It's like putting down an animal. But I think that bias creeps into any study that you do. And it's kind of what is your thought process behind the study, right? I want to do this study to validate my practice. I want to do this study to really answer a question. I want to do this study because I think this drug needs to be out there or this procedure needs to be out there. And that will creep in. And so if you're a part of it, I think it's much easier to adopt it because you understand it, you've lived it, you've been a part of it. And then you see the results you want or didn't want.
I think that the main thing to take away from this is figure out what it's going to take for a paper to change your practice. I know for me, if you've got something that has been studied appropriately, they've approached it, like Brian said, they're trying to answer a question, they're not trying to validate their practice or their drug or their piece of equipment that they want to use, but they're really trying to answer a question, that's a good start. From there, did they have an appropriate amount of people? If they had 50 people, I don't know. It doesn't make me feel as comfortable as 50,000. That makes me feel really comfortable. And then what are they trying to accomplish? Are they trying to say that they're ruling something out, or are they trying to say that this is an appropriate treatment for somebody that's going to have good efficacy? So figure out what it's going to be, because medicine keeps changing. Eventually, someday, we're going to find out that video laryngoscopy is superior to direct laryngoscopy. It may happen. I don't know. I'm still waiting for the evidence to be clear. I'm not convinced yet.
So. I don't know about that. I'm just doing DPLs on everybody, and I've also decided that colocentesis is the way.
I trephinated this guy's head the other day. His headache is much better now. The humors are gone, and he feels a lot better. So, in closing, keep an eye out for these papers and really try to talk about them. Ask other people about them. I ask people all the time about what do they think of this? Do they actually practice that? And I take most everything with a grain of salt. You figure out how you're going to practice and how you're going to apply some of this new literature that comes out.
So. Right. I agree, Aaron. And I think taking some of the articles that you look at, if it's looking at a specific drug, it's going to take a lot more for me to convince my practice to change, especially if it's a drug you need to see absolute risk reduction and see big numbers. You don't need relative risk reduction. Any drug trial is going to be something that's going to come out, it's going to look good. The first papers are always going to be much better than what it's really going to be. But at the same time, if it's a management or clinical decision rules, those you can apply easier and sooner. And then you just have to decide, does that help me? Does it help me in my practice? Is it different than what I do? There's so many clinical decision rules out there. But if you're doing that in your history and physical and that's your practice, you don't need to remember the clinical decision rule. But if it's validated in a paper, you feel better about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So keep doing what you're doing and don't memorize this clinical decision rule. But they're great for electronic records.
Yes. Yeah, they're very nice to be able to stand there and say, hey, somebody studied the fact that that's the way I think and that that's okay.
Yeah, you don't have to talk to patients. Just keep clicking.
And that's fantastic. Awesome. Well, thanks again. Any farewell advice for our seniors?
Farewell advice to seniors, I think... In 30 seconds, show up on time and show up early for your first year. Be nice to everybody. Get to know your nurses. When you get to your new department, open up every case that you have, whether it's the thoracotomy tray, chest tube tray, airway boxes. Open up, find things, get lost in the department, get lost in the hospital. And I think killing people with kindness is much better than any antagonistic relationship, and you'll always come out on top.
We're just flat out killing them.
Or killing them. Suffocating love.
So this is the last one of the year, right?
Yeah, this is it. Do you have any advice for our outgoing seniors?
Trust your gut. Trust your feeling. If something doesn't add up, if something doesn't make sense, it's probably not right.
My advice would be make friends with as many people as you can in your new job. Nurses, paramedics, consultants, hospital admin people, administrative assistants, get their cell phone numbers, become friends with them so that, and do favors with them for them so that if you need them, you can call them and they go, oh yeah, so-and-so. Yeah, sure. I'll be happy to help you out. I have collected so many cell phone numbers over the past 5 years that if I call that person, they won't answer the phone and say, who's this? They'll answer the phone and go, hey, Aaron, what's going on? Hoping that it's collegial, and then I spring something awful and medical onto them. So if you can have those at your fingertips, they are incredibly, incredibly useful.
So as, at least for the first year and for as long as you possibly can, try to have a good relationship with people where you're willing to do favors for them, because you know in the ER when you need a favor cashed in, you need it now.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, because they'll call you and say, hey, my daughter's sick or something. She's coming into the ER. Can you take care of them? And you know, you do that a couple times, and all of a sudden the relationship completely changes.
And you do it nicely, because probably their daughter's not sick and they should have taken them to their PCP.
Yeah.
But you smile and then you say, absolutely. Hey, let me call you if any of your results come back different. What's your cell phone number?
Exactly.
Those cell phone numbers are gold.
Exactly.
But good luck to you guys and girls. We've enjoyed working with all of you. You're all going to do a great job, and we'll miss you. We'll see you next year. Please donate money to the podcast. I hang me up to dry.